some 3,500 years ago. The Lord spoke to Moses and communicated to him what he was going to do after the initial 9 plagues against Egypt. And Moses came to Israel and said that the Lord was going to go over Egypt about midnight one night, and he would kill the firstborn of everything in that land. But for the sons of Israel, as God put it, not even a dog would bark, because he would protect them in such a supernatural way. The Lord gave them instructions about what to do to bring about that protection for themselves, and that was to take a lamb, an unblemished lamb, a year old, to take care of it for a period of a couple of weeks, and then to kill it at twilight of that night. They would then be required to take some of the blood from the death of that lamb and put it around their doorposts, around their house, to identify themselves. God said they were supposed to then eat the meat from the lamb, eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. And they should eat it with their loins girded, their sandals on their feet, their staffs in their hands, and to do so quickly, because it was the Lord's Passover. So it happened just that way. At midnight of that Passover night, the Lord did come, and he struck down the firstborn of all the land of Egypt, as it's described from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on the throne, all the way down to the firstborn of the cattle who were in the fields. So there was great grief among the Egyptians that night. And as God had promised, there was not anything that happened to the sons of Israel. The Egyptians said, "Get up and get out of this place." They had had enough of God's plagues. And Israel, on that Passover night, moved out across the desert. You fast forward some 1,500 years from that initial event, and you get to the days and the life of Jesus. And we are studying in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 22 what's going on in this season of life for Jesus, but not just the season of his ministry as a whole, but this season of the Passover there in and around Jerusalem. Just several days prior to what we'll look at this morning, Jesus had healed the rich young ruler, or he had interacted with the rich young ruler and directed him to get rid of his possessions. He had healed Bartimaeus. He had brought Zacchaeus into the faith. He was still teaching the people, encouraging them to follow after God. He would spend times on the Mount of Olives in the evening, and then he would come down into the city of Jerusalem and teach. On Sunday, there had been the triumphal entry. On Monday, he had cleansed the temple. On Tuesday and Wednesday, we've spent most of our time in the past few weeks on these 2 days. We had the contest of questions between him and his enemies. We had the Olivet Discourse, where he answers his disciples' questions about the end times. And then we have the plot that we looked at last week, devised by, in a spiritual sense, Satan, devised by Judas and Jesus' physical enemies, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We have Thursday, and that's what we'll look at today, and then you know Friday, Jesus is crucified. So today, let's look at preparing for God's last Passover on this Thursday of the Passion Week, and we find this in Luke 22, specifically verses 7 through 13. Then came the first day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. And Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us, so that we may eat it." They said to him, "Where do you want us to prepare it?" And he said to them, "When you have entered the city, a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house that he enters. And you shall say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher says to you, where is the guest room in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' And he will show you a large furnished upper room. Prepare it there." And they left and found everything just as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover. This is one of those passages on the surface that you think, not much to see here. Maybe we should just move on to the next passage to get to some real theological meat. I promise you that is not the case. In fact, I have never found one passage in all of Scripture where that was the case. So the issue is with us in looking at just the surface of something. But once you start to dig, you just see treasure below the surface. So let's look at this preparing for God's last Passover, and we get first in verse 7 to the timing of the preparations. It's all about preparations. The timing here is significant. Look what Luke writes. Then came the first day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Back in verse 1, Luke says that the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is called the Passover, was approaching. Now it is here. The time has come for the events to begin to unfold. The day is upon Jesus, and the timing is going to be, as you see, in control by him as he leads his disciples through the process. Remember the details of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You have the Passover itself on the 14th of the month of what's called Nisan, which would be our March and April. And then from the 15th through the 21st, you have the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Those specifics are given to us in the book of Leviticus. Over the history of Israel, the term Passover came to represent all those days put together. And to understand what's going on as far as the people go, everybody is pouring into Jerusalem to celebrate this feast. Luke identifies the feast again with the word the Passover. Now, we need to see the close link between this particular holiday and between the death of Jesus Christ. Just look at this passage here. Beginning with verse 1, you see in that verse the word Passover. You move down to verse 7, and you see the word Passover. The next verse, go and prepare the Passover for us. Look down to verse 11. You see the word Passover. Finally, verse 13, the very last word of the verse, Passover. This is significant, and we want to be able to wrap our arms around why it's significant. Think back to what occurred at the first Passover. You had God's anger or God's wrath being poured out upon the land of Egypt, and they suffered greatly when that occurred. However, anybody who had the blood that God provided and they identified with themselves, under that blood, protected by the blood in that house, they didn't suffer anything. They were protected. You move forward to Christ's death, and you see the same idea that God's wrath, God's anger is being poured out upon Jesus. And his blood, as we identify with it, it protects us. We live in the house of Jesus, in a sense. And his blood is painted on the doorpost of our souls. And so as God looks upon us and we understand the entire planet deserves God's wrath because of our rebellion against him, as he looks upon those who have painted the blood of Jesus, in a sense, on the doorpost of their souls, God says, you're okay. Not because they're any better. In fact, as you think about Israel and Egypt, Israel's actions weren't much better than the Egyptians. It's just because of God's goodness. He chose Israel out of Egypt and sent them on their way. He chooses us who put their faith in Jesus Christ the same way and sends us on our way. So the connection here between the first Passover and this last Passover is crucial. We can think that, well, God's creative. He could have had Jesus die anytime during the calendar year. Maybe associated with a different Jewish holiday, or maybe on a Monday sometime. What about a Wednesday? But as you understand the significance of the holiday, this was the day that Jesus had to die. This was the connection. In fact, if you take a step back and think of the chronology of things that occurred from God's perspective, this is why the first Passover occurred the way that it did, because of the plan in his mind about him sending his son to die on that cross on that key day. It had to be the Passover. So just as God passed over Israel, Christ will offer himself as the Passover, and we put our faith in him, and God passes over us in his judgment. So don't miss the significance of the Passover in the passage. Luke again says, "Then came the first day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed." Now, Luke is writing again to a non-Jewish audience. We know that because he tells us a detail that for us is important, that the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. But for anybody who was Jewish, that would be like somebody explaining, well, Christmas is on the 25th of December. And we'd say, well, you don't need to say that. Everybody knows that already because of the culture. You understand the different Gospels that we have. They have different audiences. And sometimes you wonder, well, how do you know there was a different audience for Luke as compared to Matthew? Well, you look at details like this and say, well, Matthew was writing to a Jewish audience because of all the Old Testament quotations he uses and the communication about the kingdom. Only a Jewish person would get that. Luke's writing to a Gentile audience. And details like this tell us that a Gentile needs to hear this. No Jewish person needs to hear this. So the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. The lamb had to be slain by the head of the family. Exodus 12, verse 6 gives us this detail. He was the one who was responsible. And the lamb would be sacrificed in the afternoon in preparation for the evening meal that was to be shared by the family. Now, I want to alert you to an apparent discrepancy as you look through the four Gospels. When we look at an apparent contradiction in Scripture, remember it's only contradictory in our minds. Man can't understand all the details, and so we look at something again on the surface and we say, how do these things go together? It takes work to harmonize the accounts of the Gospels in certain circumstances, but it all fits together seamlessly from God's perspective because he's the one who understands how it all fits together. But if we do some work and study a little bit, oftentimes we can grasp what the truth behind it is. Here's the discrepancy, the apparent discrepancy. In the synoptic Gospels, that's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they communicate Jesus eating the Passover meal in the evening and being crucified the next day, right? He eats the Passover meal with his disciples. He gets arrested later in the Garden of Gethsemane. He spends the whole night, and then in the morning they assemble for the trial, and then he's crucified that next day in the middle of the day, right? The Gospel of John, however, there are verses in the Gospel there that speak about the Passover meal being eaten after Jesus' death. So again, on the surface, you think, well, who's right? Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or John? Do you just say, well, it's three against one, so we're going to go this way, and John just had it a little bit wrong? No, that's not a good way to bring these things together. Turn to the Gospel of John. Let me show you just a couple of these instances. John chapter 18 and verse 28. Jesus is being led to Pilate. And John writes, "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. And they themselves," these are Jesus' enemies who are behind the arrest, "they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover." So they're going to eat the meal later that day. Another place, chapter 19 and verse 14. "Now it was the day of preparation for the Passover." Well, wait a minute, I thought Jesus already ate the Passover with his disciples. How do we bring this together? Was Jesus crucified on Thursday or Friday? The answer is by understanding historically there were two different methods of looking at the calendar, two different times of celebrating the Passover. The first was this, looking at a day from sunrise to sunrise. The second was looking at a day from sunset to sunset. Now, those who looked at a day from sunrise to sunrise, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are communicating that perspective as they write about what occurs. Many of the Pharisees looked at a calendar day this way. And so from Josephus, the Mishnah, which is a collection of rabbinic wisdom, other ancient Jewish sources, the Jews in the north of Israel, including Galilee, looked at the calendar this way. Galileans celebrated the Passover meal on the first day, Thursday evening, because the Passover had just started when the sun set on that night. The lambs were killed that day, so Passover officially began after sundown. Now, on the other side, you had those who looked at the calendar from sunset to sunset. This is what John communicates. And by the way, each method of looking at the calendar finds support in the Old Testament. So it's not that one's right and one's wrong. It's just different. The Sadducees looked at the days this way, and the Judeans would do all of the details of the Passover on Friday. Again, we draw from Josephus, the historian, from the Mishnah, that collection of rabbinic writings, and other ancient Jewish literature. And we learn that Jews in southern Israel, including Jerusalem, looked at the calendar this way. So John views the events from the point of view of the Sadducees, who controlled the temple. That's where all the arrest is going on and everything's happening right there in and around the temple. Jesus was killed at the normal time the Passover lambs were killed, on the afternoon of Nisan 14, the 14th of Nisan. This was the normal time for the Passover lambs to be slain. But apparently, the authorities of the temple, the leaders in and around Jerusalem, had compromised with those who followed the other calendar and allowed the Passover to be celebrated by them on Thursday. So for those from the north who looked at the calendar from that perspective, the preparations for the Passover would be on Thursday. They would eat the meal Thursday night. From those in the south who were focused more on the temple, the preparations for the Passover would be on Friday, and the Passover would be eaten later that day. This difference explains why Jesus and his followers had already eaten the Passover meal, but Jesus' enemies had not eaten the Passover meal yet. So they were still preparing that day. Now, that's just a little bit below the surface. To go even further below the surface, look at the magnificence of this detail of history and how it fits in with God's plan. Thursday afternoon, the lambs were slain and prepared for those who would celebrate the Passover that night. Jesus eats the Passover meal with his disciples that evening. And the next day, as he's arrested, brought to trial, and then he's crucified. He's crucified at the very same time. All the Passover lambs are being killed in preparation for the Passover meal that night. Jesus and the disciples ate the Passover meal Thursday night. Jewish leaders who arrested and tried Jesus are going to eat the Passover meal Friday night. So Jesus would celebrate the Passover meal at that Last Supper with his disciples. All the significance there. Why that had to happen there. And he would also die at the exact time thousands and thousands of lambs were being slaughtered. The timing here is controlled by God. It's not just random. You see, in God's sovereignty over history, allowing these two traditions to unfold so that Jesus might die at the exact same time when the Passover lambs were being sacrificed, and that he might be able to eat the Last Supper with his disciples. If there was only one day where this was celebrated, that could not have happened. Jesus' death was the fulfillment of Passover. Every lamb that was sacrificed, not just that day, not just the day before, but for the previous 1,500 years, pointed toward Jesus' own death. There is safety in the blood of Christ then and now. Think about how different it would have been if there was just one meal. It would have to have been worked out by God, and he certainly could have done this. But we see his providence at work, not just on that day, not just on that week, but over the centuries, and allowing these traditions to develop. Oftentimes we, as followers of God, we worry about circumstances. You know, we make our plans, and then something changes. Maybe not something even related to us, but something major changes, and it causes a shift, and we begin to be concerned. But you think about God not just as sovereign over small things, but over major things, like the fact that why do all the people in the north celebrate Passover on a different day? And if we were to look at it over the centuries, we would say, what is God going to do now? Because now people are celebrating Passover differently. How is he going to work all the details out? But again, he's not just reacting to details. He's behind the details. And he allows things to occur, not just in a micro, but in a macro sense. And they come together because we are given the promise in Scripture. He works all things together for good. Not just little details in our lives, but grand details that encompass entire nations or entire regions. He brings those together. So as you understand God's goodness, you trust him more. As you understand that not only can he take care of one individual, but he can take care of an entire calendar and how people will view it differently and use that for his glory as he brings together two different times of celebrating Passover in such a beautiful way. Look now at the knowledge of the preparations. Back to Luke 22. Again, Luke has said, then came the first day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. We see Jesus' directive here, beginning in verse 8. And Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, go and prepare the Passover for us, so that we may eat it. The Passover meal had to be eaten within the city walls of Jerusalem, if you were there in and around Jerusalem. So there had to be preparations. Jesus tells Peter and John, go and prepare the meal. The preparations would occur during the daylight hours on Thursday. And again, representatives from each family would have the priest slaughter a lamb for them in the temple, and they would take that meat and bring it home and use it to feed the family that night. Remember, there are no grocery stores. There are no pre-prepared Passover meals in a box that you could just carry home. There is work that needed to be done. And so Peter and John are given the instructions to find the lamb, prepare it, get a meal ready for 13 people, Jesus and his disciples. And the purpose for all of this was that they would eat the meal together. And you think about what Jesus is doing here. Even as he faces his death, which will be just in hours now, he's serving others by preparing others for their task. This week didn't catch Jesus by surprise. This day didn't catch Jesus by surprise. He's in control. And so he gives them their instruction. Look how they respond in verse 9. They understand his directions, but they say, where do you want us to prepare it? Only Jesus knows where they're going to eat this Last Supper. Remember, the Jewish leaders are trying to kill him, but it's not yet time. It will be in a few hours, but right now and during this particular meal is not the time for him to give himself up. And so the place is secret. Jesus is being shrewd. The details are given next, beginning in verse 10. And he said to them, "When you have entered the city, a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house that he enters." All right, what we're going to see here in the details is a blending of Jesus' omniscience and his sovereignty. The idea that he knows everything and the idea that he's in control of everything. And those two have to go together as you think deeply theologically about it. He says, when you have entered the city. Remember, they're staying in the evenings on the Mount of Olives. And so the city is Jerusalem. When you go into Jerusalem, a man will meet you, carrying a pitcher of water. This was a task normally performed by a woman, so it might be easy to recognize a man carrying a pitcher of water. It seems, as Jesus describes it, that the disciples don't know this man. He doesn't say, "You'll find so-and-so, one of our fellow disciples," and he'll point things out to you. This is just a man carrying a pitcher of water. A sign for them. And then he says, follow him into the house that he enters. This almost reads a little bit like a spy novel, right? You're looking through the details. Okay, you're going to see a man, and here's what he's going to be doing. And just follow him, and he'll lead you into a place. And then don't interact with him. You'll interact with somebody else. The owner of the house, we'll see in just a moment. But the man is just a guy walking with a pitcher, and they're to follow him. Verse 11, and he shall say to the owner of the house, this is most likely a disciple, because he's going to allow them to make preparations at his house. It seems that Jesus had made some prior arrangements with this owner of the house. But still, he's the only one who knows where the location is. Think about this man who's carrying the pitcher of water. It doesn't seem that Jesus organized that detail. Like, is he going to have the man stand there with a pitcher of water waiting for the disciples to come in at a certain time? I mean, it could have, but it seems more that this is just his omniscience, that he knows where the house is. He knows that there's going to be a man who's walking into that house with a pitcher of water. He knows Peter and John are going to come into the city, and they're going to see that man and just follow him in. So part of it is Jesus exercising the plan that he has set into motion. Part of it is just he knows exactly all the details of what's going on in and around that plan. And so he brings those together. Again, he's secretive because of his enemies, the Pharisees and the religious leaders. He's also secretive because who's with him at this time? Judas. Look back to verse 6. After Judas had met with the chief priests and the officers about betraying Jesus, it says he consented and began seeking a good opportunity to betray him to them apart from the crowd. Jesus had to hide the location of the Last Supper together from Judas. Now, Judas would be there at the beginning, but Jesus didn't want him to know where it would be. Jesus could have easily said, when you go into the city, the house is the third one on the left off of this street. You'll see it. It's brown, and you just enter into it. But no, he uses this man walking in with a pitcher of water so as to keep the location secret. Remember, Judas is looking for a time where Jesus is by himself, and he can be arrested apart from the crowds. What a great opportunity to have Jesus arrested as he's eating the meal with his disciples in this upper room. Nobody would know about it except the 13 of them. And so if Jesus reveals the location of this place to Judas, no doubt Judas runs to the authorities and say, "I know where he is. I know where he's going to be at this time tonight. We're going to eat the Passover there together. Go in that room." And you can imagine the difference of the account if in the middle of the Passover meal, the authorities come in and arrest Jesus there. Jesus is sovereignly in control of his own suffering, down to the very minute when he's going to allow it to begin to happen. again, verse 11. And you shall say to the owner of the house, the teacher says to you, the teacher, that's like a code name, huh? The teacher says to you, where is the guest room in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples? This is similar to when the disciples are told to go into the city and untie a colt that doesn't belong to them. And Jesus says, if anybody asks you about it, just say, well, the Lord has need of it. This owner has a home that includes a guest room. Again, these details seem to have been worked out before by Jesus with the owner. The word guest room there is also used back in Luke chapter 2 and verse 7, where it's translated inn. There was no room for them in the inn. So this guest room on the second level there, in the upper room as it's described, is the place where the group would come together and partake of the Passover supper. Look at verse 12. We get a little bit of a description there of the room, and he will show you a large furnished upper room. Prepare it there. The furnishings would include carpets and couches, a low table, pillows for reclining. Mark adds for us in his gospel that it was ready for the banquet. Again, it's a furnished upper room. There's no reason to think that this upper room is the same as the upper room mentioned in the book of Acts. We see Jesus' perfect knowledge here. You could ask him any detail about anything going on around this circumstance, and he would have given you the answer. And that's good for us to remember as we think about what awaits us. You think about the question, what awaits me? You know, do you really believe in the Lord's sovereignty? Do you really believe in the Lord's omniscience? Do you really understand that any circumstance, any situation that you face, he could give you every single detail of every single person, of every single item, all the timing of it? He knows. Nothing surprising him. And again, as we trust him, that brings us comfort because there's nothing that he's missing. Finally, look at verse 13, the trustworthiness of the preparations. And when we say trustworthiness, we have Jesus' preparations first in the beginning of the verse, and then the disciples' preparations at the end of the verse. And they left, this is Peter and John, and found everything just as he had told them. I guess we wouldn't expect any other description there. Again, the same sort of detail that's given to us back in Luke 19 when those who were sent away went away and found the colt tied there just as he had told them. So the room is furnished. It is ready. Nothing is taking Jesus by surprise. The faithfulness of the preparation shows them that they can trust him. He's trustworthy. He knows what's going to happen. Think about the disciples. Think about what they're going to move through in the next 24 hours. The fact that he's going to be arrested and crucified. They're all going to flee. But if they can think back on every single detail that Jesus gave about all the details of where they're going to eat this Passover meal, they could be encouraged by the fact that he knows. This is not something that is hitting him as a surprise. And they left and found everything just as he had told them. Then we have the disciples' preparation, and they prepared the Passover. Obedient and faithful men. Apart from Judas, the other disciples had their hearts molded by the Lord for month after month after month of ministry, and they were trustworthy. The preparations would involve organizing the sacrifice of the lamb in the temple, as we said, and then roasting the lamb, preparing the side dishes, which included unleavened bread, bitter herbs, wine. There would be utensils and dishes involved. And each food dish for the Passover meal, it's a reminder to the people of the Exodus from Egypt. The roasted lamb would, of course, commemorate the lamb which was slain for each household and its blood painted on the outside door. The unleavened bread, bread with no yeast, so it didn't rise at all, recalls the bread that was made and eaten in haste because of how God had given the instruction. The bitter herbs were eaten with the bread, and they were a symbol of the bitterness of Israel's slavery in Egypt. God understands who we are as people. He understands the importance of remembering. I think it's fair to say that you would describe your mind as leaky, because our minds are leaky. We forget things. We forget the importance of things. We might remember little details, but we need to be reminded of how significant certain ideals or principles are. And traditions help us to have our minds reminded so that we keep these things more to the forefront of our thinking. We have holidays, and the purpose of the holiday is to remind us to be thankful, to remind us of Christ's birth, to remind us of Christ's death and burial and resurrection. And these happen through any typical calendar year, and we are reminded about details. We have to fill up those leaky minds regularly, or we'll find them empty. And this happens annually in relationship to holidays. This happens weekly in relationship to gathering together in a church service. This happens daily as you wake up in the morning and you spend those first moments, those first hours with God, because we forget the importance of the Lord, so we have that devotional time to reorient our thinking and then move through our day. We see this in the Old Testament and the New Testament with the Passover, with the different feasts that God had instructed Israel to celebrate so they wouldn't forget. We see this in our own culture as we celebrate holidays. We see this significantly in our celebration of communion. Jesus says, do this in what? In remembrance of me. So yeah, we can just intellectually think about things, but going through the activities of traditions really instills those things in our minds. So let's not think that they are unimportant, as we see detailed out here in the Passover for Egypt or for Israel. Well, everything is now prepared for God's last Passover. And as we move forward and see the Lord's death, we understand that it's more than just a mere example for us about how to be sacrificial toward people. There was a substantive purpose for Jesus' death, and that was to appease the wrath of God. For all who would believe, there is salvation, there is atonement. We have ourselves here moving forward to the killing of the true Passover lamb. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5:7, clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ our Passover also has been sacrificed. So during the time of the Exodus, the Israelites expressed their faith by obeying and painting the doorpost of their houses with the blood of the Lamb. Now we are called to paint the door of our hearts with the blood of the Lamb. Capital L rather than small L. We see continuity here in Christ our Passover. We see the planning here and the timing and the knowledge and the trustworthiness of the preparations. And our prayer is that we would remember Christ our Passover as we move through the end of Jesus' life in our study of the Gospel of Luke.